behind the refrigerator. A sheet of plywood had been nailed across the room's only window, and there was a single dim light bulb hanging from the ceiling. Under the light bulb was a large, heavy old table, the kind with square legs and a white porcelain finish. A large mirror hung on the wall at an angle that allowed it to reflect whatever was on the table. And in that reflection, lying in the middle of the table was a... Well, I assume it had started life as a human being of some kind, quite probably male and Hispanic. Very difficult to say in its present state, which, I admit, left even me a bit startled. Still, in spite of being surprised, I had to admire the thoroughness of the work and the neatness. It would have made a surgeon very jealous, although it seems likely that very few surgeons would be able to justify this kind of work to an HMO. I would never have thought, for instance, of cutting off the lips and eyelids like that. And although I pride myself on neat work, I could never have done so without damage to the eyes, which in this case were rolling wildly back and forth, unable to close or even blink, always returning to that mirror. Just a hunch, but I guessed that the eyelids had been done last, long after the nose and ears had been oh so neatly removed. I couldn't decide, however, if I would have done these before or after the arms, legs, genitals, etc. A difficult series of choices, but from the look of things, it had all been done properly, even expertly, by someone who'd had plenty of practice. We often speak of very neat bodywork as surgical, but this was actually surgery. There was no bleeding at all, even from the mouth, where the lips and tongue had been removed. Even the teeth. One had to admire such amazing thoroughness. Every cut had been professionally closed. A white bandage was neatly taped to each shoulder where arms had once hung, and the rest of the cuts had already healed, in a way you might hope to find in the very best of hospitals. Everything on the body had been cut off. Absolutely everything. There was nothing left of it but a bare and featureless head attached to an unencumbered body. I couldn't imagine how it was possible to do this without killing the thing, and it was certainly far beyond me why anyone would want to. It revealed a cruelty that really made one wonder if the universe was such a good idea after all. Pardon me if this sounds a tad hypocritical coming from Death Head Dexter, but I know very well what I am. And it's nothing like this. I do what the dark passenger deems necessary to someone who truly deserves it, and it always ends in death, which I am sure the thing on the table would agree was not such a bad thing. But this, to do all this so patiently and carefully, and leave it alive in front of a mirror, I could feel a sense of black wonder drifting up from deep inside. As if for the very first time, my dark passenger was feeling just a little bit insignificant. The thing on the table didn't appear to register my presence. It just kept making that deranged doggy sound, non-stop, the same horrible wavering note, over and over. I heard Deb scuffle to a halt behind me.
"Oh, Jesus," she said. "Oh, God, what is it?"
"I don't know," I said. "But at least it's not a dog." Chapter 8. There was a very quiet rush of air, and I looked beyond Deborah to see that Sergeant Doakes had arrived. He glanced once around the room, and then his eyes settled on the table. I admit that I had been curious to see what his reaction would be to something this extreme, and it was well worth the wait. When Doakes saw the kitchen's central exhibit, his eyes locked onto it, and he stopped moving so completely that he could have been a statue. After a long moment, he moved toward it, gliding slowly, as if pulled on a string. He slid past us without noticing that we were there, and came to a stop at the table. For several seconds, he stared down at the thing. Then, still without even blinking, he reached inside his sport coat and drew out his pistol. Slowly, with no expression, he aimed it between the unblinkable eyes of the still yowling thing on the table. He cocked the pistol.
"Dokes," said Deborah in a dry croak of a voice, and she cleared her throat and tried again. "Dokes!"
Dokes didn't answer nor look away, but he didn't pull the trigger, which seemed a shame. After all, what were we going to do with this thing? It wasn't going to tell us who had done this, and I had a feeling its days as a useful member of society had come to an end. Why not let Dokes put it out of its misery? And then Deb and I would reluctantly be compelled to report what Dokes had done. He would be fired, and even imprisoned, and my problems would be over. It seemed like such a neat solution, but of course it was not the kind of thing Deborah would ever agree to. She can get so fussy and official at times.
"Put away your weapon, Dokes," she said, and although the rest of him remained absolutely motionless, he swiveled his head to look at her.
"Only thing to do," he said, "believe me."
Deborah shook her head.
"You know you can't," she said.
They stared at each other for a moment, then his eyes clicked onto me. It was exceptionally hard for me to look back without blurting out something like, "Oh, what the hell, go for it." But I managed somehow, and Dokes turned the pistol up into the air. He looked back at the thing, shook his head, and put the pistol away.
"Shit," he said. "Should have let me."
And he turned, walking rapidly out of the room. Within the next few minutes, the room became crowded with people who tried desperately not to look while they went to work. Camilla Figg, a stocky, short-haired lab tech who had always seemed to be limited in expression to either blushing or staring, was crying quietly as she dusted for fingerprints. Angel Bautista, or Angel No Relation, as we called him, since that is how he always introduced himself, turned pale and clamped his jaw tightly shut, but he stayed in the room. Vince Masuoka, a co-worker who normally acted like he was only pretending to be human, trembled so badly he had to go outside and sit on the porch. I began to wonder if I should pretend to be horrified too, just to avoid being too noticeable. Perhaps I should go out and sit beside Vince. What did one talk about at such times? Baseball? The weather? Surely one wouldn't talk about the thing we were running from. And yet, I found to my surprise that I wouldn't mind talking about it. In truth, the thing was beginning to raise a mild twitch of interest from a certain interior party. I had always worked so hard to avoid any kind of notice at all, and here was someone doing just the opposite. Clearly, this monster was showing off for some reason, and it may have been only a perfectly natural competitive spirit, but that seemed a little irritating, even while it made me want to know more. Whoever did this was unlike anyone else I had ever encountered. Should I move this anonymous predator onto my list, or should I pretend to swoon with horror and go sit outside on the porch? As I pondered this difficult choice, Sergeant Dokes brushed past me again, for once barely even pausing to glower at me. And I recalled that because of him, I had no chance to work through a list at the moment. It was mildly disconcerting, but it did make the decision seem a little easier. I started composing a properly unsettled facial expression, but got no further than raising my eyebrows. Two paramedics came rushing in, all focused importance, and stopped dead when they saw the victim. One of them immediately ran from the room. The other, a young black woman, turned to me and said, "What the fuck are we supposed to do?" Then she started crying too. You have to agree she had a point. Sergeant Doakes's solution was starting to look more practical, even elegant. There seemed very little point in whisking this thing onto a gurney and dashing through Miami traffic to deliver it to a hospital. As the young lady had so elegantly put it, what the fuck were they supposed to do? But clearly somebody had to do something. If we just left it there and stood around like this, eventually someone would complain about all the cops throwing up in the yard, which would be very bad for the department's image. It was Deborah who finally got things organized. She persuaded the paramedics to sedate the victim and take it away, which allowed the surprisingly squeamish lab techs to come back inside and go to work. The quiet in the little house as the drugs took hold of the thing was close to ecstatic. The paramedics got the thing covered and onto the gurney without dropping it, and wheeled it off into the sunset. And just in time, as the ambulance pulled away from the curb, the news trucks started to arrive. In a way, it was a shame. I would love to have seen the reaction of one or two of the reporters, Rick Sangre in particular. He had been the area's leading devotee of "If it bleeds, it leads," and I had never seen him express any sense of pain or horror, except on camera, or if his hair was mussed. But it was not to be. By the time Rick's cameraman was ready to roll, there was nothing left to see other than the little house fenced in by the yellowed tape, and a handful of cops with clamped jaws, who wouldn't have had much to say to Sangre on a good day, and today probably wouldn't have told him his own name. There was really not a great deal for me to do. I'd come in Deborah's car, and so I didn't have my kit. And in any case, there was no visible blood spatter anywhere that I could see. Since that was my area of expertise, I felt I should find something and be useful. But our surgical friend had been too careful. Just to be sure, I looked through the rest of the house, which wasn't much. There was one small bedroom, an even smaller bathroom, and a closet. They all seemed to be empty, except for a bare, battered mattress on the floor of the bedroom. It looked like it had come from the same thrift shop as the living room chair, and had been pounded flat, like a Cuban steak. No other furniture or utensils, not even a plastic spoon. The only thing that showed even the smallest hint of personality was something Angel No Relation found under the table as I finished my quick tour of the house. "Hola," he said, and pulled a small piece of notepaper off the floor with his tweezers. I stepped over to see what it might be. It was hardly worth the effort, nothing but a single small page of white paper, ripped slightly at the top where a little rectangle had been torn away. I looked just above Angel's head, and sure enough, there on the side of the table was the missing rectangle of paper, held to the table with a strip of scotch tape. "Mira," I said, and Angel looked. "Aha," he said. As he examined the tape carefully, tape holds fingerprints wonderfully well, he put the paper on the floor, and I squatted down to look at it. There were some letters written on it in a spidery hand. I leaned over farther to read them. "Loyalty." "Loyalty?" I said. "Sure. Isn't that an important virtue?" "Let's ask him," I said. An Angel shuddered hard enough that he almost dropped his tweezers. "Me cago en diez with that shit," he said, and reached for a plastic bag to put the paper into. It hardly seemed like something worth watching, and there was really nothing else to see, so I headed for the door. I certainly am not a professional profiler, but because of my dark hobby, I often have a certain amount of insight into other crimes that seem to come from the same neighborhood. This, however, was far outside the bounds of anything I had ever seen or imagined. There was no hint of any kind that pointed toward personality or motivation, and I was intrigued nearly as much as I was irritated.
What kind of predator would leave the meat lying around and still wiggling like that?
I went outside and stood on the porch. Doakes was huddled with Captain Matthews, telling him something that had the captain looking worried. Deborah was crouched beside the old lady, talking quietly with her. I could feel a breeze picking up, the squall breeze that comes right before the afternoon thunderstorm. And as I looked up, the first hard spatters of rain pelted down on the sidewalk. Sangre, who had been standing at the tape, waving his microphone and trying to get the attention of Captain Matthews, looked up at the clouds too, and, as the thunder began to rumble, threw his microphone at his producer and lurched into the news van. My stomach rumbled, too, and I remembered that I had missed my lunch in all the excitement. This would never do. I needed to keep up my strength. My naturally high metabolism needed constant attention. No diet for Dexter. But I had to depend on Deborah for a ride, and I had the feeling, just a hunch, that she would not be sympathetic about any mention of eating at the moment. I looked at her again. She was cradling the old lady, Mrs. Medina, who had apparently given up retching and was concentrating on sobbing. I sighed and walked to the car through the rain. I didn't really mind getting wet. It looked like I was going to have a long wait to dry off. It was indeed a long wait. Well over 2 hours. I sat in the car and listened to the radio and tried to picture, bite by bite, what it was like to eat a medianoche sandwich. The crackle of the bread crust, so crisp and toasty it scratches the inside of your mouth as you bite down. Then the first taste of mustard, followed by the soothing cheese and the salt of the meat. Next bite, a piece of pickle. Chew it all up. Let the flavors mingle. Swallow. Take a big sip of iron beer, pronounced Iron Beer, and it's a soda. Sigh. Sheer bliss. I would rather eat than do anything else except play with the passenger. It's a true miracle of genetics that I am not fat. I was on my third imaginary sandwich when Deborah finally came back to the car. She slid into the driver's seat, closed the door, and just sat there, staring ahead through the rain-splattered windshield. And I knew it wasn't the best thing I could have said, but I couldn't help myself. "You look beat, Deb. How about lunch?" She shook her head but didn't say anything. "Maybe a nice sandwich? Or a fruit salad? Get your blood sugar back up? You'll feel so much better." Now she looked at me, but it wasn't a look that showed any real promise of lunch at any time in the near future. "This is why I wanted to be a cop," she said. "The fruit salad? That thing in there," she said, and then turned to look out the windshield again. "I want to nail that whatever it is that could do that to a human being. I want it so bad I can taste it. Does it taste like a sandwich, Deborah? Because..." She smacked the heels of her palms onto the rim of the steering wheel, hard. Then she did it again. "God damn it," she said. "God fucking damn it." I sighed. Clearly, long-suffering Dexter was going to be denied his crust of bread. And all because Deborah was having some kind of epiphany from seeing a piece of wiggling meat. Of course, it was a terrible thing, and the world would be a much better place without someone in it who could do that. But did that mean we had to miss lunch? Didn't we all need to keep our strength up to catch this guy? Still, it didn't seem like the very best time to point this out to Deborah. So I simply sat there with her, watching the rain splat against the windshield, and ate imaginary sandwich number 4.
This ends Disc 2. Dearly Devoted Dexter, Disc 3.
The next morning, I had hardly settled into my little cubicle at work when my phone rang.
Captain Matthews wants to see everybody who was there yesterday, Deborah said.
Good morning, sis. Fine, thanks. And you?
Right now, she said, and hung up.
The police world is made up of routine, both official and unofficial. This is one of the reasons I like my job. I always know what's coming, and so there are fewer human responses for me to memorize and then fake at the appropriate times. Fewer chances for me to be caught off guard and react in a way that might call into question my membership in the race. As far as I knew, Captain Matthews had never before called in everybody who was there. Even when a case was generating a great deal of publicity, it was his policy to handle the press and those above him in the command structure, and let the investigating officer handle the casework. I could think of absolutely no reason why he would violate this protocol, even with a case as unusual as this one. And especially so soon. There had barely been enough time for him to approve a press release. But right now still meant right now, as far as I could tell. So I tottered down the hall to the captain's office. His secretary, Gwen, one of the most efficient women who had ever lived, sat there at her desk. She was also one of the plainest and most serious, and I found it almost impossible to resist tweaking her.
Gwendolyn, vision of radiant loveliness, fly away with me to the blood lab,
I said as I came into the office. She nodded at the door at the far end of the room.
They're in the conference room, she said, completely stone-faced. Is that a no?
She moved her head an inch to the right.
That door over there, she said. They're waiting.
They were indeed. At the head of the conference table, Captain Matthews sat with a cup of coffee and a scowl. Ranged around the table were Deborah and Doakes, Vince Masuoka, Camilla Figg, and the four uniformed cops who had been setting the perimeter at the little house of horror when we arrived. Matthews nodded at me and said,
"Is this everybody?"
Doakes stopped glaring at me and said,
"Paramedics."
Matthews shook his head.
"Not our problem. Somebody will talk to them later."
He cleared his throat and looked down, as though consulting an invisible script.
"All right," he said,
and cleared his throat again.
The event of yesterday, which occurred at, Northwest 4th Street, has been interdicted, at the very highest level.
He looked up, and for a moment I thought he was impressed.
"Very highest," he said. "You are all hereby ordered to keep to yourselves what you may have seen, heard, or surmised in connection with this event and its location. No comment, public or private, of any kind."
He looked at Doakes, who nodded, and then he looked around the table at all of us.
Therefore,
Captain Matthews paused and frowned as he realized that he didn't actually have a therefore for us. Luckily for his reputation as a smooth talker, the door opened. We all turned to look. The doorway was filled with a very big man in a very nice suit. He wore no tie, and the top three buttons of his shirt were undone. A diamond pinky ring glittered on the little finger of his left hand. His hair was wavy and artfully mussed. He looked to be in his 40s, and time had not been kind to his nose. A scar ran across his right eyebrow and another down one side of his chin, but the overall impression was not disfigurement so much as decoration. He looked at us all with a cheerful grin and bright, empty blue eyes, pausing in the doorway for a dramatic moment before he looked to the head of the table and said,
"Captain Matthews?"
The captain was a reasonably large man and masculine in a very well-kept way, but he looked small and even effeminate compared to the man in the doorway, and I believe he felt it. Still, he clenched his manly jaw and said,
"That's right."
The big man strode in to Matthews and held out his hand.
"Nice to meet you, Captain. I'm Kyle Chutsky. We talked on the phone."
As he shook hands, he glanced around the table, pausing at Deborah before moving back to Matthews. But after only half a second, his head snapped back around, and he locked stares with Doakes, just for a moment. Neither one of them said anything, moved, twitched, or offered a business card, but I was absolutely positive they knew each other. Without acknowledging this in any way, Doakes looked down at the table in front of him, and Chutsky returned his attention to the captain.
"You have a great department here, Captain Matthews. I hear nothing but good things about you guys." "Thank you, Mr. Chutsky," Matthews said stiffly. "Have a seat."
Chutsky gave him a big, charming smile. "Thanks, I will," he said, and slid into the empty seat next to Deborah. She didn't turn to look at him, but from my spot across the table, I could see a slow flush climbing up her neck, all the way to her scowl. And at this point, I could hear a little voice in the back of Dexter's brain, clearing its throat and saying, "Excuse me, just a minute, but what the hell is going on here?" Perhaps someone had slipped some LSD into my coffee, because this entire day was beginning to feel like Dexter in Wonderland. Why were we even here? Who was the battered big guy who made Captain Matthews nervous? How did he know Doakes? And why, for the love of all that is shiny, bright, and sharp, was Deborah's face turning such an unbecoming shade of red? I often find myself in situations where it seems to me like everyone else has read the instruction book, while poor Dexter is in the dark and can't even match tab A with slot B. It usually relates to some natural human emotion, something that is universally understood. Unfortunately, Dexter is from a different universe and doesn't feel nor understand such things. All I can do is gather a few quick clues to help me decide what kind of face to make while I wait for things to settle back onto the familiar map. I looked at Vince Masuoka. I was probably closer to him than any of the other lab techs, and not just because we took turns bringing in donuts. He always seemed to be faking his way through life, too, as if he had watched a series of videos to learn how to smile and talk to people. He was not quite as talented at pretending as I was, and the results were never as convincing, but I felt a certain kinship. Right now he looked flustered and intimidated, and he seemed to be trying hard to swallow without any real luck. No clue there. Camilla Figg was sitting at attention, staring at a spot on the wall in front of her. Her face was pale, but there was a small and very round spot of red color on each cheek. Deborah, as mentioned, was slumping down in her chair and seemed very busily engaged in turning bright scarlet. Chutsky slapped the palm of his hand on the table, looked around with a big happy smile, and said,
"I want to thank you all for your cooperation with this thing. It's very important that we keep this quiet until my people can move in on it."
Captain Matthews cleared his throat.
I assume you will want us to continue our routine investigation procedures and the, interrogating of witnesses and so on."
Chutsky shook his head slowly.
"Absolutely not. I need your people all the way out of the picture immediately. I want this whole thing to cease and desist, disappear. As far as your department is concerned, Captain, I want it never to have happened at all."
"Are you taking over this investigation?" Deborah demanded.
Chutsky looked at her, and his smile got bigger.
"That's right," he said.
And he probably would have kept smiling at her indefinitely, if not for Officer Coronel, the cop who had sat on the porch with the weeping and retching old lady. He cleared his throat and said,
"Yeah, okay, just a minute here."
And there was a certain amount of hostility in his voice that made his very slight accent a little more obvious. Chutsky turned to look at him, and the smile stayed on his face. Coronel looked flustered, but he met Chutsky's happy stare. Are you trying to stop us from doing our jobs here?
Your job is to protect and serve, Chutsky said. In this case, that means to protect this information and serve me.
That's bullshit, Coronel said.
It doesn't matter what kind of shit it is, Chutsky told him. You're going to do it.
Who the fuck are you to tell me that?
Captain Matthews tapped the table with his fingertips. That's enough, Coronel. Mr. Chutsky is from Washington, and I have been instructed to render him every assistance.
Coronel was shaking his head. He's no goddamn FBI, he said.
Chutsky just smiled. Captain Matthews took a deep breath to say something, but Doakes moved his head half an inch toward Coronel and said, Shut your mouth.
Coronel looked at him, and some of the fight went out of him.
Don't want to mess with this shit, Doakes went on. Let his people handle it.
It isn't right, said Coronel.
Leave it, said Doakes.
Coronel opened his mouth. Doakes raised his eyebrows. And on reflection, looking at the face underneath those eyebrows, perhaps, Officer Coronel decided to leave it. Captain Matthews cleared his throat in an attempt to take back control.
Any more questions? All right, then. Mr. Chutsky, if there's any other way we can help.
As a matter of fact, Captain, I would appreciate it if I could borrow one of your detectives for liaison. Somebody who can help me find my way around. Dot all the T's. Like that.
All the heads around the table swung to Doakes in perfect unison, except for Chutsky's. He turned to his side, to Deborah, and said,
How about it, Detective?
Chapter 9. I have to admit the surprise ending to Captain Matthews' meeting caught me off guard, but at least I now knew why everyone was acting so much like lab rats thrown into a lion's cage. No one likes to have the feds come in on a case. The only joy in it is making things as hard as possible for them when they do. But Chutsky was apparently such a very heavy hitter that even this small pleasure would be denied to us. The significance of Deborah's bright red skin condition was a deeper mystery, but it wasn't my problem. My problem had suddenly become a little bit clearer. You may think that Dexter is a dull boy for not putting it together sooner, but when the nickel finally dropped, it was accompanied by a desire to smack myself on the head. Perhaps all the beer at Rita's house had short-sheeted my mental powers. But clearly, this visitation from Washington had been called down upon us by none other than Dexter's personal nemesis, Sergeant Doakes. There had been some vague rumors that his service in the Army had been somewhat irregular, and I was starting to believe them. His reaction when he saw the thing on the table had not been shock, outrage, disgust, or anger, but something far more interesting. Recognition. Right at the scene, he had told Captain Matthews what this was and who to talk to about it. That particular who had sent Chutsky. And therefore, when I had thought Chutsky and Doakes had recognized each other at the meeting, I had been right. Because whatever was going on that Doakes knew about, Chutsky knew about too, probably even more so. And he had come to squash it. And if Doakes knew about something like this, there had to be a way to use his background against him in some small way, thus flinging the chains off poor, detained Dexter. It was a brilliant train of pure, cool logic. I welcomed the return of my giant brain and mentally patted myself on the head. Good boy, Dexter. Arf, arf. It is always nice to see the synapses clicking in a way that lets you know your opinion of yourself is sometimes justified. But in this particular case, there was just a chance that more was at stake than Dexter's self-esteem. If Doakes had something to hide, I was a step closer to being back in business. There are several things that dashing Dexter is good at, and some of them can actually be legally performed in public. One of these things is using a computer to find information. This was a skill I had developed to help me be absolutely sure about new friends like McGregor and Riker. Aside from avoiding the unpleasantness of cutting up the wrong person, I like to confront my fellow hobbyists with the evidence of their past indiscretions before I send them off to dreamland. Computers and the internet were wonderful means of finding this stuff. So if Dokes had something to hide, I thought I could probably find it, or at least some small thread of it that I could yank on until his whole dark past began to unravel. Knowing him as I did, I was quite sure it would be dismal and Dexter-like. And when I found that certain something, perhaps I was being naive to think I could use this hypothetical information to get him off my case, but I thought there was a very good chance. Not by confronting him directly and demanding that he cease and desist or else, which might not be entirely wise with someone like Dokes. Besides, that was blackmail, which I am told is very wrong. But information is power, and I would certainly find some small way to use whatever I found. A way to give Dokes something to think about that did not involve shadowing Dexter and curtailing his crusade for decency. And a man who discovers his pants are on fire tends to have very little time to worry about somebody else's box of matches. I went happily down the hall from the captain's office, back to my little cubicle off the forensics lab, and got right to work. A few hours later, I had just about all I could find. There were surprisingly few details in Sergeant Dokes's file. The few that I found left me gasping for breath. Dokes had a first name. It was Albert. Had anyone ever really called him that? Unthinkable. I had assumed his name was Sergeant. And he had been born, too, in Waycross, Georgia. Where would the wonders end? There was more, even better. Before he had come to the department, Sergeant Dokes had been Sergeant Dokes in the Army, the Special Forces of all things. Picturing Dokes in one of those jaunty green beanies marching alongside John Wayne was almost more than I could think about without bursting into military song. Several commendations and medals were listed, but I could find no mention of any heroic actions that had earned them. Still, I felt much more patriotic just knowing the man. The rest of his record was almost completely empty of details. The only thing that stood out at all was an 18-month stretch of something called detached service. Dokes had served it as a military advisor in El Salvador, returned home to a 6-month stretch at the Pentagon, and then retired to our fortunate city. Miami's police department had been happy to scoop up a decorated veteran and offer him gainful employment. But El Salvador. I was not a history buff, but I seem to recall that it had been something of a horror show. There had been protest marches down on Brickell Avenue at the time. I didn't remember why, but I knew how to find out. I fired up my computer again and went online. And oh dear, find out I did. El Salvador, the time Dokes was there, had been a true three-ring circus of torture, rape, murder, and name-calling. And no one had thought to invite me. I found an awful lot of information posted by various human rights groups. They were quite serious, almost shrill, in the things they had to say about what had been done down there. Still, as far as I could tell, nothing had ever come of their protests. After all, it was only human rights. It must have been terribly frustrating. PETA seems to get much better results. These poor souls had done their research, published their results detailing rapes, electrodes, and cattle prods, complete with photos, diagrams, and the names of the hideous, inhuman monsters who reveled in inflicting this suffering on the masses. And the hideous, inhuman monsters in question retired to the south of France, while the rest of the world boycotted restaurants for mistreating chickens. It gave me a great deal of hope. If I was ever caught, perhaps I could simply protest dairy products, and they'd let me go. The El Salvadorian names and historical details I found meant very little to me. Neither did the organizations involved. Apparently, it had developed into one of those wonderful free-for-alls, where there were no actual good guys, merely several teams of bad guys with the campesinos caught in the middle. The United States had covertly backed one side, however, in spite of the fact that this team seemed just as eager to hammer suspicious poor persons into paste. And it was this side that got my attention. Something had turned the tide in their favor, some terrible threat that was not specified, something that was apparently so awful it left people nostalgic for cattle prods in the rectum. Whatever it was, it seemed to coincide with the period of Sergeant Doakes's detached service. I sat back in my rickety swivel chair. Well, 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 I thought. What an interesting coincidence. At approximately the same time, we had Doakes, hideous unnamed torture, and covert U.S. involvement, all buzzing about together. Naturally enough, there was no proof that these three things were in any way linked. No reason at all to suspect any kind of connection. Just as naturally, I was as sure as I could be that they were very much three peas in one pod. Because 20-some years later, they had all come back together for a reunion party in Miami. Doakes, Chutsky, and whatever had made the thing on the table. It was starting to look like Tab A would fit into Slot B after all. I had found my little string, and if only I could think of a way to pull on it. Peekaboo, Albert. Of course, having information to use is one thing. Knowing what it means and how to use it is a different story. And all I really knew was that Doakes had been there when some bad things happened. He probably hadn't done them himself, and in any case, they were sanctioned by the government. Covertly, of course, which made one wonder how everyone knew about it. On the other hand, there was certainly somebody out there who still wanted to keep this quiet. And at that moment, that somebody was represented by Chutsky, who was being chaperoned by my dear sister, Deborah. If I could get her help, I might be able to squeeze a few details out of Chutsky. What I could do then remained to be seen, but at least I could begin. It sounded too simple, and of course it was. I called Deborah right away and got her answering machine. I tried her cell phone, and it was the same thing. For the rest of the day, Debs was out of the office. Please leave a message. When I tried her at home that evening, it was the same thing. And when I hung up the phone and looked out the window of my apartment, Sergeant Doakes was parked in his favorite spot across the street. A half moon came out from behind a tattered cloud and muttered at me, but it was wasting its breath. No matter how much I wanted to slip away and have an adventure named Riker, I could not. Not with that awful maroon Taurus parked there like a discount conscience. I turned away, looking for something to kick. Here it was Friday night, and I was prevented from stepping out and strolling through the shadows with the dark passenger, and now I couldn't even get my sister on the phone. What a terrible thing life can be. I paced around my apartment for a while, but accomplished nothing except stubbing my toe. I called Deborah two more times, and she was not home two more times. I looked out the window again. The moon had moved slightly. Doakes had not. All righty then. Back to Plan B. Half an hour later, I was sitting on Rita's couch with a can of beer in my hand. Doakes had followed me, and I had to assume he was waiting across the street in his car. I hoped he was enjoying this as much as I was, which was to say, not very much at all. Was this what it was like to be human? Were people actually so miserable and brainless that they looked forward to this? To spending Friday night, precious time off from wage-slave drudgery, sitting in front of a television with a can of beer. It was mind-numbingly dull, and to my horror, I found that I was getting used to it. "Curses on you, Dokes! You're driving me normal." "Hey, mister," Rita said, plunking herself down next to me where she curled her feet under her. "Why so quiet?" "I think I'm working too hard," I told her, "and enjoying it less." She was quiet for a moment, then she said, "It's that thing with that guy you had to let go, isn't it? The guy who was... he killed the kids?" "That's part of it," I said. "I don't like unfinished business." Rita nodded, almost as if she actually understood what I was saying. "That's very... I mean, I can tell it's bothering you. Maybe you should... I don't know. What do you usually do to relax?" It certainly conjured up some funny pictures to think of telling her what I did to relax, but it was probably not a very good idea. So instead I said, "Well, I like to take my boat out, go fishing." And a small, very soft voice behind me said, "Me too." Only my highly trained nerves of steel prevented me from bumping my head on the ceiling fan. I am nearly impossible to sneak up on, and yet I'd had no idea there was anyone else in the room. But I turned around, and there was Cody, looking at me with his large, unblinking eyes. "You too?" I said. "You like to go fishing?" He nodded. Two words at a time was close to his daily limit. "Well then," I said, "I guess it's settled. How about tomorrow morning?" "Oh," Rita said, "I don't think... I mean, he isn't... You don't have to, Dexter." Cody looked at me. Naturally enough, he didn't say anything, but he didn't need to. It was all there in his eyes. "Rita," I said, "sometimes the boys need to get away from the girls. Cody and I are going fishing in the morning, bright and early," I said to Cody. "Why?" "I don't know why," I said, "but you're supposed to go early, so we will." Cody nodded, looked at his mother, and then turned around and walked down the hall. "Really, Dexter," Rita said, "you really don't have to." And of course, I knew I didn't have to. But why shouldn't I? It probably wouldn't cause me actual physical pain. Besides that, it would be nice to get away for a few hours, especially from Dokes. And in any case, again, I don't know why it should be, but kids really do matter to me. I certainly don't get all gooey-eyed at the sight of training wheels on a bicycle, but on the whole, I find children far more interesting than their parents. The next morning, as the sun was coming up, Cody and I were motoring slowly out of the canal by my apartment in my 17-foot whaler. Cody wore a blue and yellow life vest and sat very still on the cooler. He slumped down just a little so that his head almost vanished inside the vest, making him look like a brightly colored turtle. Inside the cooler was soda and a lunch Rita had made for us, a light snack for 10 or 12 people. I had brought frozen shrimp for bait. Since this was Cody's first trip, and I didn't know how he might react to sticking a sharp metal hook into something that was still alive. I rather enjoyed it, of course. The more alive, the better. But one can't expect sophisticated tastes from a child. Out the canal, into Biscayne Bay, and I headed across to Cape Florida, steering for the channel that cut past the lighthouse. Cody didn't say anything until we came within sight of Stiltsville, that odd collection of houses built on pilings in the middle of the bay. Then he tugged at my sleeve. I bent down to hear him over the roar of the engine and the wind. "Houses," he said. "Yes," I yelled. "Sometimes there are even people in them." He watched the houses go by, and then, when they began to disappear behind us, he sat back down on the cooler. He turned around once more to look at them when they were almost out of sight.
After that, he just sat until we got to Fowey Rock, and I idled down. I put the motor in neutral and slid the anchor over the bow, waiting to make sure it caught before turning the engine off.
"All right, Cody," I said. "It's time to kill some fish."
He smiled. A very rare event.
"Okay," he said.
He watched me with unblinking attention as I showed him how to thread the shrimp onto the hook. Then he tried it himself, very slowly and carefully pushing the hook in until the point came out again. He looked at the hook and then up at me. I nodded, and he looked back at the shrimp, reaching out to touch the place where the hook broke through the shell.
"All right," I said. "Now drop it in the water."
He looked up at me. "That's where the fish are," I said. Cody nodded, pointed his rod tip over the side of the boat, and pushed the release button on his little Zebco reel to drop the bait into the water. I flicked my bait over the side, too, and we sat there rocking slowly on the waves. I watched Cody fish with his fierce blank concentration. Perhaps it was the combination of open water and a small buoy, but I couldn't help but think of Riker. Even though I could not safely investigate him, I was assuming that he was guilty. When would he know that McGregor was gone, and what would he do about it? It seemed most likely that he would panic and try to disappear. And yet, the more I thought about it, the more I wondered. There is a natural human reluctance to abandon an entire life and start over somewhere else. Perhaps he would just be cautious for a while. And if so, I could fill my time with the new entry on my rather exclusive social register. Whoever had created the howling vegetable of Northwest 4th Street, and the fact that this sounded rather like a Sherlock Holmes title, made it no less urgent. Somehow, I had to neutralize Doakes. Somehow, some way, sometime soon, I had to... "Are you going to be my new dad?" Cody asked suddenly. Luckily, I had nothing in my mouth which might choke me, but for a moment it felt like there was something in my throat, something the approximate size of a Thanksgiving turkey. When I could breathe again, I managed to stammer out, "Why do you ask?" He was still watching his rod tip.
"Mom says maybe," he said.
"Did she?" I said, and he nodded, without looking up. My head whirled. What was Rita thinking? I had been so wrapped up in the hard work of ramming my disguise down Doakes's throat that I had never really thought about what was going on in Rita's head. Apparently, I should have. Could she truly be thinking that... It was unthinkable. But I suppose in a strange way it might make sense if one was a human being. Fortunately, I am not, and the thought seemed completely bizarre to me. Mom says maybe? Maybe I would be Cody's dad? Meaning, well, I said, which was a very good start, considering I had absolutely no idea what I might say next. Happily for me, just as I realized nothing resembling a coherent answer was going to come out of my mouth, Cody's rod tip jerked savagely. "You have a fish," I said, and for the next few minutes it was all I could do to hang on as the line whirred off his reel. The fish made repeated ferocious, slashing zigzags to the right, the left, under the boat, and then straight for the horizon. But slowly, in spite of several long runs away from the boat, Cody worked the fish closer. I coached him to keep the rod tip up, wind in the line, work the fish in to where I could get a hand on the leader and bring it into the boat. Cody watched it flop on the deck, its forked tail still flipping wildly. "A blue runner," I said. "That is one wild fish." I bent to release it, but it was bucking too much for me to get a hand on it. A thin stream of blood came from its mouth and onto my clean white deck, which was a bit upsetting. "Ick," I said. I think he swallowed the hook. We'll have to cut it out. I pulled my fillet knife from its black plastic sheath and laid it on the deck. There's going to be a lot of blood, I warned Cody. I don't like blood, and I didn't want it in my boat, not even fish blood. I took the 2 steps forward to open the dry locker and get an old towel I kept for cleaning up. Ha! I heard behind me, softly. I turned around. Cody had taken the knife and stuck it into the fish, watching it struggle away from the blade, and then carefully sticking the point in again. This second time he pushed the blade deep into the fish's gills, and a gout of blood ran out onto the deck. Cody, I said. He looked up at me, and wonder of wonders, he smiled. I like fishing, Dexter, he said. Chapter 10. By Monday morning, I still had not gotten in touch with Deborah. I called repeatedly, and although I became so familiar with the sound of the tone that I could hum it, Deborah didn't respond. It was increasingly frustrating. Here I was, with a possible way out of the stranglehold Doakes had put me in, and I could get no further with it than the telephone. It's terrible to have to depend on someone else. But I am persistent and patient, among my many other Boy Scout virtues. I left dozens of messages, all of them cheerful and clever, and that positive attitude must have done the trick, because I finally got an answer. I had just settled into my desk chair to finish a report on a double homicide. Nothing exciting. A single weapon, probably a machete, and a few moments of wild abandon. The initial wounds on both victims had been delivered in bed